So on the schedule right now, it says Dharma Talk and Discussion. And I will offer some reflections, but I thought we'd start with discussion, comments, questions, reflections from what you've been noticing in your practice since we started with this yesterday. So just to start there and see what kinds of comments, questions, or reflections there are from you. And I can always talk, but I'd really like to have it be related to what's going on for you. So let's start with your thoughts. Yeah, and let's see, the mic back.
I had a question come from this morning's set.
Try again.
Is that better? Yeah, okay. And there's this, and maybe you answered it, because maybe it's just about states of consciousness, but in being, there's a place that arises where the experience is more of being awareness, is what it feels like. So it's a sort of peaceful, quiet space.
Uh-huh.
And then everything just kind of rises and falls in consciousness, right?
Yeah.
So is it still useful at that point to ask, what am I aware of?
So you're describing a place or a state where you're kind of already aware and knowing that you're aware.
Uh-huh.
And what I'd say is at that point you're more recognizing it already. And the use of the questions, that's kind of a little bit of the art of the practice, you know, when to use them, when to let them go. It sounds to me like it's fine to let them go at that point.
Okay, yeah, that's why I was asking.
It still can be useful to use the question, what's my attitude? Okay. Or is something else happening that I'm not consciously aware of?
Right, because there can be a spacing out in that state too.
Or just, it's not even just a spacing out, but just that you're aware of things that you're familiar with being aware of, and there's something going on that's a kind of bigger or...
Okay.
So sometimes there can just be dropping in that question, is there something else happening here? And then not looking for it, but just seeing it, you know, so the dropping the question in, you drop the question in, and then see how does that question impact what you're aware of? So just dropping in the question, is there something else happening right now? And then not expecting anything or looking for anything, but just being available for what might show up.
Okay, good. And then can I ask a separate question or should... Okay. This may be more psychological, so if it's not relevant, but I noticed when I was walking around today, being awareness or, you know, checking in and out, there's another part of me that just wants to go on vacation. Right? Like... I'd like to just go for a week in the mountains and not even try to be aware. I would just like to just hang out. It might result in the same thing. And the question, it's kind of a two-sided question. One is like, where's that impulse coming from? And second, is there more effort there then? Am I making more effort than I need to, that I'm drawn to that?
So, there's the question of what's going on there is one that only you can answer. And so the fact that you have that question, that's great. It's like, you know, so you've got this impulse to just go and not do anything or not try to be mindful. I don't know if it's an active, I don't want to be mindful, or if it's more, I just, you know, I'm kind of tired of all this doing. I'd rather just be, that kind of sense. So curiosity about that. Because, you know, that could be coming from either a place of wisdom or a place of delusion. So I can't answer that. It really is very personal and very much what's going on in your mind in terms of why that's coming up. You know, I've seen in my own practice both sides. I've seen sometimes the urge to not do the mindfulness because, you know, what is coming up is something that is hard to be with. And not that I can't be with it, but that, you know, but that it's like, wow, I really wish I didn't have to watch that. Really wish I didn't have to go there. And yet sometimes that's exactly what we need to do. I remember at one point on one retreat, I was spending a lot of time looking at the pattern of self-hatred. And, you know, it would come up at various times. Sometimes it would be there, sometimes it wouldn't be there. And then one evening, I remember it came up, and I just kind of committed to myself, I'm just going to go back to my room and sit with this and see what's going on. And I was sitting in my room, and then the final bell rang, you know, to either go to the sitting or something. So the final bell, and I thought, oh, I should do that. And then I thought, no, what I need to do is just stay here, you know. So there was kind of the wish to not have to be with this thing, this self-hatred. And instead, I just commit, no, this is actually what I need to be doing right now. So there was a kind of resistance that I knew was coming from it was coming from delusion. It was coming from that place. But there have been other times where I've had that sense of, wow, enough with this doing already. And it's coming from wisdom. It's like that there has been an over-efforting.
Yeah, now that you speak about that, that's what was interesting. Because there's absolute love and wonder while I'm walking around. So it's not like I'm not having a good time. And still there's that urge.
Yeah. And so I would be curious about the urge. And also, I would say a lot of the time, at least it seems to me quite a bit of the time, when we have that kind of an urge, more often than not, or more than we might think, the movement to double down and say, well, I really should stay here, I should really try to be mindful, that's just over-efforting. And that what's being asked for there is check out, you know, how little effort do I need to actually be here right now? So it's not about saying I don't want to be mindful, but it's kind of more around the mind telling us at some level. And as I said, this can come from wisdom or delusion. This level of effort is not what I want to do right now. And sometimes that can be wisdom, that actually you're trying too hard, you're over-efforting, you are getting in the way. So, you know, something about this, the efforting piece, you know, we do have to make an effort to be mindful. But at some point, there's kind of a momentum of mindfulness. And we can, as I've been talking about, get familiar with that experience of awareness itself. And then we can just ride that experience of awareness and be aware and just know that we're aware without having to do it, without having to make the effort to do it. When we are making the effort to be mindful, there are certain things that we can see and certain things that we can't see. So when we're trying to be mindful, we can usually be attentive to things that we're already familiar with. So we can choose, okay, I'm going to pay attention to the breath and I'm going to stay with the breath. And we can do that. But there's a certain point in practice where what's asked of us is to not do the practice, but to have cultivated enough continuity for the practice to start doing itself. And at that point, there are things that kind of mindfulness can see that the kind of mindfulness that we're doing cannot. Because the efforting around mindfulness is a pretty gross function of mind. And it will obscure subtle experiences. And so there is a time and a place for backing off of the effort. And yet it's an art form. You know, we do have to recognize that if we back off too far and we're just spacing out, it's like, well, maybe that's not so useful either.
Yeah, the effort of mindfulness has gotten painful.
Yeah, and
maybe
and when that happens,
that something else is.
Sometimes the question I ask myself is, how little effort do I need to be here? You know, just kind of back off. Sometimes I can back off. It's like, okay, I can let go of that. Oh yeah, I'm still mindful. How about letting go more? Oh yeah, still mindful. Okay, let go more. Oh yep, still mindful. It's like there's sometimes we can play with that side of it. Let's let go of the effort and see what happens. Yeah.
I want to speak to over-efforting also. I think the word I like to use is discipline of mind, but I've had the feeling these 2 days of practice that it's like I let the dog off the leash and it's running around, and when there's an instinct in me to say, bad dog, don't go there, you know, that you're not supposed to do that. It's amusing, but it's also true that I'm still trying to discipline the dog off the leash, if that metaphor makes any sense.
Yeah. You know, so it's interesting. What I'd like to suggest is a different use of that metaphor, which is you have a dog on a very long leash. So you're still connected with it. You know, it's not like the dog is just gone and you can't find it. But, you know, you're giving it a lot of leeway. You know, it's like, okay, yeah, go smell that pile of poo. Okay, you know, stick your nose in it. Oh, go romp in that pile of mud. You know, it's and yet you still got your hand on the leash, so that you know that if it's getting too far into something dangerous, there's a way you can kind of bring it back. But there is, I think, a habit we have about certain states of mind or certain experiences that we shouldn't be having while we're meditating. And it's not the experience or the state of mind that we're having. It's our relationship to it that's most important. Can we know it as a human experience? Can we recognize and be curious about how it's being put together? So this brings what we would call right mindfulness or wise mindfulness into the equation. And whatever is happening in experience, if we have this perspective of curiosity about, well, what is this experience? This is a human experience. It's being felt here in this moment. What is this experience? That's very different than letting the dog get lost. It's a very different experience. And so that understanding that it's not the experience that's telling us whether we are in a good place or not. It's how we are with it. And this is why checking the attitude, checking the relationship to experience is so important. And so I'd encourage that. So you've got a kind of a meta attitude about what you should and shouldn't be experiencing in meditation. And many of us have that. So you're not alone by any means. And just noticing that is, oh, thinking that shouldn't be happening. That's a human experience too. And so we kind of back our way into the perspective of wise attitude or the okayness by noticing when we have a perspective that is off. So we recognize, oh, think that shouldn't be happening. Oh, well, okay, thinking it shouldn't be happening, that's what's happening. That's a human experience too. Can I know that? Can I allow that?
Thank you. I appreciate the use of the word, which often is curiosity. That's very helpful to me.
Yeah. Thanks. In the back and then over here. Yeah. Oh, we'll go to Betsy afterwards.
My awareness tells me I didn't get enough practicing before to come back, but it seemed, I can't remember how many months it's been since I came back, but everything, I'm being able to hear what you're saying. I'm being able to almost know what's being said. And the gift is, now when I, you know, came late, I had about, oh, I don't know how many things to do this morning, which, you know, should. And I left each one without, you know, being to the finish. But as I left one of the deals I was at, I got to the next one, I realized it was the perfect thing, but not planned. Uh-huh. Then I had to leave that one to come here. I don't know if the third one I came here, fourth one I came here. And then when I come here, I'm feeling, gee, I shouldn't have my hat in here, but I'm cold. So I went to my car, and I was going to make a phone call. But I got in the back seat, and it was so warm, I was able to sit and be with some of what you said. But my memory, you know, I have the beginning of dementia, and my memory, I'm accepting it.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, okay, it's okay. So I'm an old woman, and I'm...
But there's not much we can do but accept it.
Two, I was very careful of what I ate. And I'm drinking tonic water and water, hot water. That, but everything that everyone has said, just I'm being able, I can't take notes as a rule. This has always been my whole life since I went to school, whatever. All of a sudden, I think I'm going to be able to decipher. My handwriting is pretty bad. The gift, the one gift I really have now to take with me and to remember, is get this practice in so it'll come back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The last retreat, I think, was, anyway, there's one of them that you had, and you handed out a different book that I'm still reading. I haven't finished it. But to digest it. And now, as what I've heard today and yesterday, I know, I'm trusting the powers of the universe knows exactly what I need, even to eat. Because I can't believe what I'm realizing. I think that you just said to, back up.
Back off on the effort.
But yeah, an experience to check it out and to pause in the process of it happening. And, of course, I've got the monkey mind up there going, no, you got to do this for this person. You got to do that. And what you said here is freed me of chains that I got around me with my shoulds.
Mm.
Anyway.
Thank you. To Betsy and then to Valeria. And there's another mic on the stage, Valeria. You can use that one when you're...
Well, Rosemary and I both heard backing off on the effort, and as did many of the other commenters today. And where I was backing off in my walk this afternoon, it somewhat tied in with your comments before the intermission on sleepiness. I was observing that I had it some lively acuteness around seeing and hearing, and then it spread. And I thought, well, what would happen if I relaxed my eye muscles and just softened? The term guarding the sense doors was in my mind. And I thought, what if the guard were a little less alert?
Mm-hmm.
And it was not so dissimilar from that gauzy, woozy feeling that you get right before you. And so I thought it was an interesting but unsuccessful experiment.
Why unsuccessful?
Well, it was interesting. So I learned something, but I'm not sure if what I learned was just particular to me at this moment in time. And that's why it's possible that it's just particular to me, my life experience. Anyway, I accept that. But is this a moment in time thing? Because I noticed as I relaxed my eye muscles, not one sense, but all of the senses became reduced in the acuteness that shifts that, for instance, extra pixels bring to a picture.
Uh-huh, yeah.
There was a softer edge to everything.
Yeah. And why is that?
And it, so it wasn't, I couldn't select out for vision and not select in the other senses, which I found, I don't know if I can extrapolate from that one-time experience.
Well, I think one of the most interesting pieces to notice is, so you kind of backed off or relaxed the eye, and you noticed how that also relaxed other senses as well. And you know that, but at the same time, you know what was going on there wasn't necessarily that you were becoming less mindful. Did it feel like you were becoming less mindful there?
Ultimately, it did.
Okay,
but so short term, not, but yeah. Ultimately, yes, because then it all faded out, and I got to the park and went, "Whoa, hello, park."
Yeah, so my sense of that is very much what I was talking about earlier. It's like you relaxed the kind of preciseness of attention. That's one way that we can be mindful, is to be very precise, to be, you know, kind of really curious about what's this and what's this. And there's kind of a sharpness or experience pops in a way. And we're really interested in the objects, in effect. You know, it's like that seeing, we're interested in what is seen. And that's a way that mindfulness can be experienced. And what you did essentially was back off on the kind of, it sounds like the intensity or the intention to kind of connect.
Well, I actually physically relaxed.
Yeah, physically relaxed. Okay, so you physically relax the eyes. And that creates something new happening that is kind of about stepping back from the engagement with the object, and more about stepping back to, well, perhaps relaxation of mind or relaxation of senses. That's a more vague experience. I was talking about vague experiences before, you know, in particular around sleepiness. But it's a more vague experience, that relaxation of the senses. Because it's a vaguer experience, and at first you could kind of touch into it, things feel kind of gauzy. You also notice the kind of distancing almost from your other senses, so a sense of kind of stepping back or coming into cotton balls or something, like, you know, it kind of just feels like you're kind of engulfed in something that's not so sharp or something. You notice that, and because it's not such a clear, precise experience, this is my guess, partly because it's not such a clear, precise experience, and many of us are more familiar with being attentive to clear, precise experiences. So it was an unfamiliar experience, and because of that, the mind eventually kind of lost attentiveness because it wasn't so able to. It's as we open to these vague, more diffuse, less familiar experiences, the mind will wander. Because they are unfamiliar. And so rather than thinking that wasn't successful or that was, you know, that's, you know, that leads me to non-awareness, so I shouldn't do that. It's more like, well, it did lead to non-awareness, but not because of just the softening, but because of the unfamiliarity. And in order to get more familiar with things we're unfamiliar with, we have to play with it.
May I ask a follow-up then? Have you found, as you yourself have explored this more vague area, that can, where awareness is less steady, or continual awareness is less steady, I hear what you're saying about the unfamiliar and the benefits to exploring the unfamiliar. Are there other benefits?
Well, we have no idea what freedom looks like. There's no way we can know that. When the mind lets go, there's no way that we can anticipate what that is going to be. This is kind of practice for being available for freedom. I would call it that. Practice for being available for what we have no idea is coming. Valeria.
So, my question has to do with a general one, has to do with the way we know reality.
The way we know?
We know reality,
reality,
our experience.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So we have the five senses and the mind. So I was wondering, how do emotions interplay at that level in receiving reality?
That's a huge question. What I would say is it's integral. It's huge how emotions impact how we receive reality. Emotions function kind of like filters or perspectives on the world. And, I mean, we can see this kind of, or even kind of in a mind experiment. Try and come up with a good one. Well, I can't really, but, you know, just, you know, envision if you're really happy one day, you know, whatever happens, it's kind of more like, oh, well, you know, that's okay, or, you know, but if you wake up and you're really tired and grumpy, those same things happen, and it's not okay, and you're feeling impinged on, and, you know, you're blaming the world, or you're blaming yourself, and that mood or that emotion creates this filter through which we meet the world. And so it's huge. It's a huge impact on us. And the exploration isn't so much, I think, to try to become emotionless, but to become more aware of this flavor of emotion. This is how this flavor impacts the world. These are the things I take in. This is the way I take things in. So that we're not, so those, when those emotions are functioning and we're not aware that they are influencing our reality, we're in a state of delusion. When we can be more aware, there still may be some delusion there, but at least we're aware that we may be in a state of delusion. At least we're aware that we're being impacted by how we're feeling. So it's huge. It's a huge impact, and there's probably a lot to say about it, but what I would just encourage is a curiosity around noticing your emotional state and how it influences what you're seeing. I had one example on retreat. Here's an example from a retreat. You know, I noticed that I was in a state of aversion. I was doing walking meditation, and for some reason, I knew pretty well. I didn't like being in rooms with lots of people, and you know, there was. It's nighttime. That's where you do the walking meditation on retreat. This room was full, and I was in my state of aversion and noticing the aversion, and I turned around at the end of the walking path and saw somebody else's shoes at the end of my walking path, and my mind just exploded with anger. It's like, I knew that it wasn't the shoes. You know, it was the aversion. It was the state of aversion that created that reactivity. If I had been in a state, I've been in states of peace or delight or joy, and I've turned around and I've seen something unexpected, and it's more like, wow, look at that. You know, look at those shoes. Oh my gosh. You know, so I knew that it was the state of mind. And we're continually being influenced by our emotions. But also our emotions themselves are they themselves are constructed. You know, they themselves are not just inevitable. They are based on our conditioning, based on our beliefs, based on our views. And so sometimes if there's a very sticky emotion, it can also be interesting to kind of go a little bit underneath it. We can get curious about, well, okay, what's being believed? What's being believed here? And do I actually believe that? You know, if I had investigated the belief when I was doing that walking meditation, I might have come up with something of the belief like, there should not be so many people in this room. there are this many people in this room. It's like, this is the reality. So to begin to recognize, you know, that beliefs often are just ridiculous, that can begin to help us decouple from those beliefs. And sometimes when we notice a belief, though, we notice a belief and it's like, yeah, I believe that one. That, and not that we're trying to not believe our beliefs, but we are trying to recognize that they are beliefs. So when we notice a belief, we may notice a kind of a range of levels of belief, let's say, you know, from buying into it fully, it is truth, I absolutely think this is true, to, wow, that doesn't even make any sense. So we can not only notice what the beliefs are, but something about how much we believe them. So beliefs and emotions are also intimately connected, so it's interesting to explore that part too.
So could we put emotions in the same kind of next to the mind in terms of how we meet reality?
So what do you mean? I don't quite understand the question.
Yeah, because I was trying to understand, you know, how Buddhism, you know, explains or how we meet reality through the five senses and the mind. So, but then I was, you know, this comes from an experience. I was outside I was not walking, but I was standing and really trying to take in experience. And I was very aware that emotions were filtering what I was feeling, a very, you know, very direct way or... So then this question comes from there. So how?
So what I would say is that the experience of emotions is a part of the reality that needs to be known. Again, we're not going to find our way to an emotionless place. There will be, you know, what seems to happen as the reactive emotions reduce is that there are wholesome heart states of equanimity, of kindness, of love, of compassion, of joy that are there. And so we don't become, you know, non-emotional beings as we practice. And what we are asked to do is to recognize, so we are asked to recognize not only our five physical senses, but also what's happening in our mind. What's happening in our mind is a part of the reality we are asked to recognize. And it's also something that, so the interesting part about the mind is that it both receives experience, so it is in a way a receiver of reality, but it also constructs our reality. So we are seeing what our mind is constructing. And there is, as far as I can tell, there's not really a way to objectively understand what is actually out there. What we can understand is this is the experience that's happening. And that's the reality the Buddha is interested in helping us explore. Because as we explore that reality, we begin to recognize and see certain things in the mind begin to construct suffering. Certain things in the mind begin to construct compassion, kindness, ease, peace, wisdom. And seeing that, the mind begins to head in the direction of the more wholesome. It's not even something we have to try to do so much, but just the willingness to meet reality in this way that I was talking about of, you know, just recognizing experience as experience. This is human experience. That perspective, which is, you know, this is a perspective of wise mindfulness, that perspective begins to reveal that constructing nature of our minds. You know, the nature of the mind to construct whatever it's habitually constructed. And seeing that feeling the pain of the unskillful constructions and feeling the release from pain of the wholesome constructions, our mind begins to naturally gravitate towards the wholesome constructions. And yet, you know, so that is what the Buddha was interested in helping us do. As far as I can tell, the Buddha was not so interested in figuring out objectively what is out there. He was interested in helping us understand what he called the world. He said, I am the knower of the world. And then he said, and what I mean by world is this body and mind. The way we experience the world is through this body and mind, and that is what he wanted us to understand, the experience. So I think of what the Buddha taught as very radically as being experiential and not any statement about the actual nature of reality. And so even using that phrase, you know, understanding reality, it takes us more back to understanding experience. There's a phrase in the text, I don't know if the word reality itself is used, but there's a phrase, yata bhuta, which means something like things as they are or things as they have come to be. And we're encouraged over and over to recognize as it is. As it actually is another translation for that. As it actually is, but it always is. It's not as it actually is that thing in the world. It's as it actually is this sight. Notice as it actually is this sound, the experience. Notice as it actually is this mind state. So we're asked to notice the experience as it is in experience. And that is the reality we're interested in. And so a good piece of that is recognizing how ideas, beliefs, emotions influence that reality, influence that experience. So keep looking at that. Yeah, thanks. Yeah.
This walk this morning, it was so different from yesterday. So yesterday, the beautiful day and the flowers and everything. And this morning, I went out the other direction in search of a cup of coffee because of the sleepiness. And it was like the Circle K, and it drips out, and it's empty. And then I go to the gas station across the street, and they're closed. And I end up at Pete's, and there's a homeless person in a wheelchair. And I get the coffee, and I come back. And the whole time I was thinking, well, Andre said, can you be aware through all that? And I actually was. I was very aware through all that. Actually, it was much easier for me to be aware than yesterday, where I probably can't remember a whole lot of any of the walks. And so there's not so much a question. It just so
it's an observation. It sounds like, in a way, a place or a time where there was more of an agenda or an activity of something you were doing helped you to be aware.
It was easier to be aware. And I was trying to be aware of being aware, though. Like, how aware am I? It was like there's the mirror with the water droplets. It was more like the mirror with the excrement splattering on it. But the mirror itself was still pristine. I don't know.
Yeah.
And I was okay. I was fine.
Yeah.
It wasn't like I got upset.
Great. I'm glad to hear that. I mean, that's a beginning to recognize. So what that's partly pointing to, the okayness of that, is the value of that work, the value of exploring, being aware of it. Because if you hadn't been aware of it, if it had just been, oh, here's that cup
It'd
and it's
miserable.
Leaking, and there would have been, you know, the reactivity and the anger and the confusion, and there would have been a lot of mess constructed, more excrement on the mirror. But as it was, you were able to know it. So
anyway,
yeah, thank you. Anyone else have any comments? So I'll just say a few words about wise mindfulness, right mindfulness. I kind of pointed to this morning a little bit in the talk this morning, but I know some of you weren't here for that. You know, the mindfulness that we're cultivating awareness of what's happening while it's happening, you know, that mirror, that pristine mirror. It's not just about knowing what's happening while it's happening. The encouragement of the Buddha was to cultivate a particular perspective of that, to cultivate a perspective of wise mindfulness, of right mindfulness. And the classic definition of right mindfulness includes the perspective of the Four Noble Truths. So recognizing suffering, recognizing that craving leads to suffering, recognizing the possibility for the ending of that craving, and recognizing that there's a path that leads to the end of suffering. And so something about an exploration of suffering and freedom from suffering is a perspective of right view. And this is, in fact, you know, what the Buddha was. His whole journey was kind of based on that. His question when he set out from his home life into homelessness was, is it possible to be free from suffering? He saw so much suffering in the world, and that was his question. Is it possible for human beings to live in this world and not have suffering? And my understanding is that he came to the recognition and the understanding that human beings live in this world and will experience unpleasantness, will experience pleasantness, unpleasantness, neutral experience. But we do not have to have the reactivity to that. The mental distress, mental pain and grief to what's happening in the world. His definition of freedom was the possibility of no more mental pain and grief. Now, that doesn't to me mean that our heart doesn't quiver with a resonance with the suffering in the world. Compassion is the open heart's response to suffering in the world. But it's not a rigid response. It's more, it kind of feels to me more like the heart is made of jello. You know, it's like it's shaking when there's suffering, but it's not breaking. So this, that there's a kind of a, compassion's an interesting emotion. It both feels exquisitely beautiful and very painful at the same time. But it is not what I would call mental pain or grief. So there are these interesting emotions that result through the practice and the letting go of mental pain and grief, the that direction. So the Buddha in his own practice discovered that it is possible to meet the world in a way where the heart is resonant and is not tight, constricted, and shattering with experience. In a way, that craving is what kind of makes the heart hard. And so that was his journey. Is it possible? And what he discovered, I think some of what he discovered, is that this quality of awareness, this capacity that we have to know that we know, it's like this is a secret key. It's a secret key to a lock that will help us find our way to that freedom from mental pain and grief. But it's not just any way of knowing what's happening while it's happening. It's, as I pointed to this morning, it's a perspective of curiosity of what is this as human experience. So looking at what the Buddha said about suffering is we need to understand suffering. He gave us instructions to go with each of these Four Noble Truths. Understand suffering, he said. And by that, and the rest of what he taught, it seems pretty clear that he didn't mean think about it and figure out where it came from, but more understand it in the experience of it. So coming back to the experiential, that the Buddha keeps pointing us back to experience. What is the experience of suffering? How does it come to be? Curiosity about it as a human experience. And so that understanding suffering is kind of the ground of our practice. And as we talk about the mindfulness practice, there's some ways in which the way we talk about being mindful, it kind of embeds this perspective without calling it out exactly. And so I just kind of want to pull to the surface those features of the way we talk about practice that help us to orient to this perspective that puts us in contact with that key that lets us open that door to head towards freedom. So one of the pieces is that we explore the possibility of noticing experience as experience. This is the experience that is happening. An experience, this is the object. Anger is arising. Anger is happening. As I don't remember whether I said it yesterday or today, but there's a vast difference between the mindful recognition, oh, this is the human experience of anger, and I'm angry. Hugely different. One, the I'm angry, basically, there's a sort of a belief in the validity of that as a perspective that something needs to happen. I need to fix something, change something, get rid of something, tell somebody they're doing something wrong, whatever it is. We've got a perspective around that. And so we've kind of bought into the whole view around that. All the story around it. And in buying into that, what we are doing, what we are tending to be doing, is to be reinforcing the notion, the story of anger. They done me wrong. They're wrong. I'm right. We're in that groove. And so we are kind of committing to anger there. We are putting our trust in anger there. We are kind of saying, that's the direction. That's what I need to do. And at the same time, we are actually missing, most likely, at least in my own understanding and experience with something like anger, for instance, when I'm angry in that way, you know, I know I'm angry, but the perspective is, at least in one case, it was this other person, they're going to be so miserable that I'm angry. And I'm going to enjoy seeing them so miserable. You know, so there's this projection into something that my mind thinks is nice, even though saying that, it's like that doesn't sound very nice. But some piece of like, yeah, I'll feel much better when that person is miserable. You know, that kind of view or that kind of perspective. And so our mind thinks it's getting something out of the anger. But what it's missing is the experience of anger, the actual experience of anger in this moment, which when we shift to that perspective of, oh, anger is happening, one of the first things we see is, oh, this hurts. This hurts me. This hurts here. This experience is painful. And that, so that perspective of understanding suffering, basically, this is that perspective, bringing in that first noble truth that we explore. Okay, anger is happening. In looking, seeing that anger is happening, we feel directly this is suffering. Because we feel directly this is suffering, our heart understands this is not the way to well-being. This is not the path towards freedom from suffering. And so in seeing that, if that's our orientation towards letting go, moving in the direction of freedom towards suffering, if our orientation is towards getting things to be the way we want them to be, that information is not going to be so picked. We're not going to pick up on that information. We're gonna double down on the getting the other person to be miserable, But if we are oriented towards freeing our own hearts from suffering, we will understand, our system will begin to understand, this experience is not on the road towards freedom. And it begins, our mind begins to kind of rework how to relate to that. So that the very opening to an experience, this is the experience that's happening. Anger is arising. We may experience pain in that, but that is a kind of education that the mind is getting that begins to redirect our hearts to turn towards freedom and away from our habits, away from our habitual tendencies. This same practice around noticing when something beautiful is happening, when the experience of connection and love and the sense of caring, if we become mindful of that, our heart feels the softness of that, the connectivity of that. It feels that it is headed on that direction. And so it's almost like this practice of curiosity of what's happening in this moment. So objects arising in this moment as experience, as human experience. Our hearts get the education of what things lead us towards freedom, what things lead us towards happiness, and what things don't. So both sides, our hearts will begin to orient. It's like this mindfulness is this amazing, this wise mindfulness, this kind of mindfulness where we are curious about what is the human experience of it and are not shying away from noticing the consequences of that human experience. We're not shying away from noticing the pain of anger. We're not shying away from noticing the beauty and the connectivity of love. That kind of honest recognition or honest mindfulness creates the conditions for our mind to begin to let go of those unwholesome patterns, the patterns, the reactive patterns. Simultaneously, it creates the conditions for our minds to move more in the direction of the wholesome. So that one perspective of notice what's happening as a human experience. That's like, that hardly sounds like right view, but that's a key piece to right view. Noticing this experience is a human experience and not shying away from that experience of humanity in this moment. Oh, that hurts. Oh, the heart feels open. So that's one piece of the meditation instruction. And so again, you know, it's not a problem when we open with mindfulness to experience and feel dukkha, we feel suffering. It's not a mistake. It's our hearts beginning to understand suffering. So that's one piece of the instruction. You know, notice this as human experience. Another piece of our encouragement, and this is a little less, I haven't talked about this quite as much in these last 2 days, but we'll talk about it more in the week, is being curious about how things come about. And so I talked about this a little bit in terms of looking at the emotions and how they impact our experience. And so we're seeing, you know, that things condition each other. It's not just that we're randomly going through life. Our conditioning from our past is influencing our choices now. Our choices now influence what unfolds in the future. And so beginning to be curious about the conditioned nature of experience, beginning to get curious about how things interplay. And so we see things like, and this begins to happen, just more naturally as we establish the continuity of mindfulness. What I've seen at least is as we just have this very simple practice of, okay, just notice this is human experience arising, a kind of a continuity of mindfulness is established, and that continuity of mindfulness begins to reveal the conditioned nature of experience. I notice aversion is arising. I notice I'm turning. I notice the seeing of the shoes. I notice the aversion and know that it is related to that prior state of mind, that it's conditioned my response to those shoes. So that the mind begins to understand something about the constructed nature of reality. This is something that can be revealed to us, seeing the conditioned nature of experience. It also can become very freeing to recognize this as we start to really touch into just how conditioned our experience is. What I'm experiencing right now, the me that's sitting here right now, it's impacted not only by my own life, but by my parents' lives and their parents' lives and the conditions in the countries in which my grandparents grew up. I mean, it's this whole kind of flow of conditions that have come to this moment for me to be here. And I spent a lot of time exploring and seeing self-hatred arise in my mind. And when I finally began to recognize, oh, this is conditioned. This is, of course, this is what's arising in the mind. Of course, it almost couldn't be any other way than this experience happening here. It was when I began to recognize it as conditioned, not as something that I could say, I'm going to stop doing this or I have control over this, but as something that can be known as a conditioned phenomenon. It's like there was so much freedom in that. It became, instead of, oh, here's self-hatred to look at again, instead of course this is arising. And there was a huge shift in the mind that allowed the possibility to be more able to open to that. As I more deeply understood, this is conditioned. It is conditioned. It's not my fault. It's a product of so many other things. That allowed me to be more curious about what was going on, to not have any resistance at all to the pattern of self-hatred arising in the mind. And only when that was possible could the mind begin to see, you know, this is just something that's being created in this very moment. It's not like there's a reservoir of self-hatred. It's like, poof, it comes up because of the conditions, but also because there's a thought and a belief in that thought. I'm a failure. I'm no good. And then a subsequent jumping on that thought. Yep, that's true. Yep, that's true. Yep, I believe that one. Yep, I am a failure. When the mind was able to get so close to that and see, because it understood the conditioned nature, it was directly because it could understand the conditioned nature that it could get that close to that experience and see, it's just a thought and a belief. It has no inherent reality, no inherent thingness to it. That was the beginning of a real deep transformation around that pattern of self-hatred. And so the kind of exploring or recognizing the conditioned nature of experience. This is actually one tool when there are difficult things happening. So these are perspectives, you know, that I'm offering, you know, right view perspectives, essentially. So experience is just experience. Just notice it as human experience. This is conditioned. Of course this is happening. These are perspectives we can consciously bring when something challenging is happening. And And I use this one a lot. The phrase that I found most congenial for myself was one that Sayadaw Utejaniya offered. This is nature. That essentially what is happening in this moment is a result of all the conditions that have come before. It's like, this is the tree that's growing right now. The seed was planted, it was watered, it was tended in some way, and it almost couldn't be any other way. Here's the tree. This is nature. What's unfolding right now is happening because of causes and conditions. And I found that just using that phrase when I was struggling with something helped to bring a balance to the mind. And so I would be, on one retreat, I was experiencing quite a bit of low-grade depression. And I would explore the depression and could use that. Okay, this is nature. Of course this is happening. To kind of remind me of that perspective. It's not about me. It's a conditioned arising. And the mind can be with that. So that using that, you know, so this is another strategy that Sayadaw offers to he sometimes would call it borrowing wisdom. You can borrow wisdom from people you respect or people you trust. And a lot of my early practice was borrowing wisdom from people. It's like, well, I don't see how this can work, but I'm willing to try it on. And so we can use that. We can borrow these phrases, even if we don't know for ourselves directly that something is conditioned. We can, you know, reflect on it as conditioned. So that's a use of, it's kind of a use of thought to help balance the mind. So there's some other reflections that can be useful too. Reflections such as, this is impermanent. This is unreliable. This is just an experience. These phrases we can bring into our practice. If we're struggling, we can bring some of these phrases in and just see if it adds a little bit of space to our ability to be with it. And then as we practice, we begin to see some of these kind of understandings for ourselves. And when I first saw that, the arising of self-hatred as a thought and believing that thought, that was so powerful. And it just struck my mind, oh, this is just a thought. There's nothing here. There's nothing inherent here. It's just a constructed thought. And seeing that directly, it was like for the next like chunk of time following that, pretty much any thought that would arise in my mind, I could remember that experience. Any thought that would kind of be heading me in the direction of some kind of struggle or suffering, it's like, yeah, this is just a thought. And so it's like borrowing wisdom from myself. It wasn't that I was directly seeing, like in that moment when I saw the thought, I was directly seeing the thought. It wasn't an idea. It was directly seeing the thought and seeing how the mind was moving in the direction of believing it. So that was a direct seeing. So there's a difference between direct seeing and using or applying this kind of wisdom with our intellect, essentially. It's a different kind of thing, but as we begin to experience some of these understandings for ourselves, we can remind ourselves of our own wisdom. We can remind ourselves of our own understanding. And sometimes it's useful to find our own language for those. So that one was, you know, that one for me was, this is just a thought. That was the words that came to my mind. This is just a thought. And so that phrase could become a resonant phrase for me when I was caught in something. This is just a thought. Let's see. That's probably enough. So just to kind of summarize what I shared here is what we are cultivating is mindfulness with a particular perspective, with a perspective of towards understanding suffering and freeing ourselves from suffering. And that perspective, we don't even really have to think about it so much, as long as we are orienting our mindfulness towards, very simply, is this the human experience? This is the human experience. And curiosity about the conditioned nature of experience. And we can use those understandings to help balance our minds through reminding ourselves of what we understand. So let's just sit for a minute, and then we'll take a walk, another walk, and we'll come back and do another sitting after that.